podcast is part of the Sports Social Podcast Network.
Football is many things. Unpredictable, exciting, colourful, passionate, absorbing, expensive.
Venal, infuriating, exasperating, time-consuming, depressing. But one thing it most certainly is not is a level playing field.
Welcome to the famous sloping pitch. Well, we interrupt this podcast almost immediately to bring you breaking news from our special panic correspondent, Chicken Licken, who has what appear to be confirmed reports that the sky is falling. The background appears to be that some football teams have recently drawn and in some cases actually lost football matches that they were scheduled to have won. In response, the Premier League is exploring ways to declare the season null and void, supported by FIFA, who've offered to take the season's very heart and bury it in the desert. Midlands football writer William Shakespeare noted that the eagle, towering in its pride of place, was by the mousing owl hawked at and killed, disappointing Chris Sutton, who had predicted an eagle win. So, season over by popular consent, except for those in Reading, Bristol, Ipswich, Portsmouth, Leighton, Stevenage, Tottenham, Arsenal, and almost everywhere else. The people of Brighton, though, were unavailable for comment. Chris? I've always wanted to see that news handover.
Yes, exactly. So Chicken Licken and Mutton Sutton in the same story. Cool. But I noticed this week that Ben Stiller and Sean Penn have been banned from travelling to Russia. Not that either of them were planning to, as far as I know, but Penn because of his outspoken opposition to the Russian invasion, and Stiller for his remake of The Secret Life of Walter Mitty. Apparently a lot of Danny Kaye fans in the Kremlin. Yes. If you want Norman wisdom, go to Albania. And Liz Truss became Prime Minister, as expected, from the moment she dressed as Thatcher for a debate, thus triggering long-dormant erotic fantasies in Tory party members. Her name joins an amazing recent trend in world politics in that it was once a go-to reference in jokes from shows like The Goons or the Carry On films.
Yes.
Frankie Howard was always banging on about his Truss, wasn't he? It's a surgical support and thus innately funny. No explanation needed for the name Trump, of course, and Johnson is the American word for a penis, whereas on this side of the pond, it's the word for a penis.
Yeah. Very, very good. Absolutely right. And a truss is exactly what we need just at the moment. I was going to try and do a joke about President Cunt, but I thought, no, I won't do it because it...
Well, wait until all the results are in.
Yeah, not on a show like this. Anyway, in this week of pain, a young friend of mine's relationship tragically broke up. His girlfriend moved all of her belongings, pausing only, and this is absolutely true, to leave a turd in the fridge. Okay. Now, we can discuss the mechanics of that later, which are quite fascinating, I have to say. But it did coincide with Thomas Tuchel's relationship with Chelsea breaking down. And he, of course, left a turd in the fridge too, in the shape of Pierre-Emerick Aubameyang. Not literally.
Yeah, no, good save.
Not literally in the shape of Pierre-Emerick Aubameyang.
Well, what a girlfriend that would be. You wouldn't let her go, would you, if she could do a turd in the shape of Pierre-Emerick Aubameyang?
Yeah, absolutely.
And, did you see that Kylian Mbappe was embroiled in an extraordinary story about the Pogba brothers? Paul Pogba claims his brother, Matthias, formerly of Wrexham, Crewe and Crawley, but presumably now fallen on hard times, and some friends of his were behind a kidnap plot to extort money from him. He was apparently taken at gunpoint to a flat in Paris and forced to hand over 100 grand in cash, in euros. And Matthias, in response...
Whose flat?
Well, they've easily found who it was. It was his brother.
Oh, right, okay.
They know who it was. And Matthias, in response, claims to have some explosive revelations, which seem to include the suggestion that Paul Pogba used a witch doctor to cast a spell on Kylian Mbappe. Brothers, you know, what a weird story that is. I mean, what spell would he want to cast on Kylian Mbappe? Does he have some vested interest in Mbappe doing badly? Or is he trying to make him do better? Who knows? I mean, I can only presume that Matthias got the idea off Karim Benzema, who blackmailed a teammate, didn't he? And they're still a hot favourite for the Ballon d'Or, despite that.
French football is jitsu. It's a lot more interesting than just Agatha Christie, you've got to say. Because
cases. They're really worth tuning into.
And sometimes really not very nice at all, I have to say.
Anyway, let's crack along. I mean, it must have been hard, don't you think, for Thomas Tuchel this summer, seeing one of the great romances of our times, the one they have dubbed Bennifer, finally come to fruition with not one, but two beautiful and glamorous weddings and happy ever after on the horizon, which is about 2 years in showbiz years. And all the while, his own great romance, the one they dubbed Tomelu Tuchel, was on the rocks. They'd decided to spend some time apart, and Romelu was in Milan. It wasn't a permanent move, not yet anyway, so maybe he would be back one day. That was the hope that Thomas secretly clung to. All summer long, he tried surrounding himself with new friends, a whole new social circle, like it says you should do in the magazines. But none of them could take the place of the one that he had lost. He became crotchety and frankly a bit weird at work, carelessly pissing people off who he needed to keep on side. But clearly his mind and his heart were elsewhere. When he said after Chelsea's surprising 1-0 defeat away to Dinamo Zagreb on Tuesday that everything was missing, my first thought was, oh no, not another burglary at the Aubameyang place. But no, when he said everything is missing, it was like a window into his broken heart. Thomas tried in vain to distract himself by hooking up once again with his ex from his Dortmund days, Pierre-Emerick Aubameyang, but that sort of thing never goes well, does it? From the very start, Pierre seemed to be hiding his true feelings behind a mask. And Tomerick to Camangle just doesn't have the same magical ring to it.
It really doesn't. It really doesn't.
What followed was sadly inevitable. I mean, yeah, so Tuchel is out.
Hold on a minute. Is there not a track to play at the end of our show?
A track to play, yes.
There's got to be a song.
Yeah, our song. Yeah, exactly. But no, so, Abramovich was known for his itchy trigger finger, wasn't he, with a succession of top managers in and out of the revolving door. Some actually made it back in and then got revolved back out again. But we didn't really know for sure about the ruthlessness of the new regime until yesterday. When 100 days in, Out, they've already actually, I think, got rid of everyone else from the Abramovich era, Granovskaya and Bruce Buck and Peter Cech and another guy called McLachlan, I think, have got rid of all those guys, and Tuchel was really the last man standing.
I felt that Burley, is that how you pronounce his name, Burley?
Let's say it is.
It's like Patrick sounds like Pierre.
Yes, Patrick.
It doesn't matter, does it, really? No. We all know who we're talking about. Anyway, I just get the feeling he's been bullied by other chairmen who've told him, you know, you're not a real chairman until you sack someone. You do know that, don't you? And they've got like a secret meeting, and he's had the blood of Thomas Tuchel wiped across his face. He's been bloodied. He's down.
Yeah, Lord of the Flies style.
Yeah,
well, he's known. He's got a reputation for blowing the others out of the water as the owner of LA Dodgers. My friend Johnny Gould, who does a baseball podcast, was telling me that one of their players is on a 10-year contract worth $400 million. I mean, that's $40 million a year. I mean, how can you guarantee that a sportsman's going to stay at the top for 10 years? It's extraordinary. I mean, what if his arm falls off or he gets it trapped in a vending machine like Homer Simpson? You know, I mean, presumably there's some cripplingly expensive insurance that goes along with that. Yeah. And Chelsea have started to become act in a similar way, haven't they? They gave Reece James a 5-year deal just recently, and they're trying to sign Mason Mount on a really long deal as well, aren't they?
Yeah, which I find interesting because, you know, they clearly have a massive turnover, both players and coaching staff, and spend a lot of money on them. And you would have thought this was a bad idea. You would have thought a 2-year contract is what you'd want to put them on.
Yeah. I mean, there's more and more these days players in their last year of their contract is a big thing where they're all sniffing around and looking for another club to play for, isn't it? So, I mean, really a 5-year deal is a 4-year deal, I guess. But because you're going to do something about it before it runs out.
Well, I mean, I think we'll definitely talk about the transfer market later on.
But yeah,
it seems
for sure,
to me
yeah.
that almost anything unsettles a player, whether it's being on a short contract or too long a contract, or, you know, just it's money that unsettles.
Well, yeah, and Chelsea had the extraordinary thing about sacking Tuchel is that Tuchel was so intricately involved in the spending spree that Burley has been on this summer, which is the most money that a club have ever spent in a transfer window in this country, and he'd got rid of the recruitment people and the director of football. So Tuchel was the guy that he was discussing these things with. And, yeah. You know, he's bought a lot of defenders, but obviously hasn't replaced Romelu Lukaku, as we said. But and people were surprised that he was in for Anthony Gordon when he really needed a focal point for his attack. And everyone thinks that now that they've seen what's happened at City, don't they? But there aren't many Ivan Dragos to go around.
Yes, exactly. This is what happens. Everybody needs wing backs all of a sudden. Everybody needs that. Everybody, you know, and City are doing exactly the opposite from what they made everybody else do, which was have a false nine.
Yes. So, and suddenly that was the genius thing, was to have a false nine. And now suddenly...
What were we thinking? What were we thinking having Jeff Astle and John Ritchie and you know, Mark Haitley?
It's a ridiculous idea. Just a nine. Let's just have a nine.
Yeah. I think one of the things that I noticed for many years is that managers, they're like boxers. Once they've been hit badly, it's very difficult to come back. You know, you can almost smell the self-belief.
Yeah.
You know, coming
well, that's
off
the old Mike Tyson quote, isn't it? Everyone has a plan until they get punched in the face.
which is a great quote.
And one that
I think
well,
should
it
be
does seem incredibly
more widely.
It does seem incredibly impatient, though, doesn't it? Because Dynamo Zagreb, the game that they lost, was the first game where he was able to line up all his big summer signings at once. So, of course, they didn't gel straight away. And, you know, they only lost 1-0. Yeah. And even Haaland couldn't hit a barn door in the Community Shield. And look at him now. You know, it does seem an extraordinary timing.
But I think what upset the chairman, you spent all of that money. And as far as I can tell, I've looked through the Dynamo side. I think nearly every one of their player... is a Croat, have been brought through the youth system or brought from other Croatian clubs, and you know, and they've got it's a bit like the tanks rolling in to the Ukraine and then it not quite happening. Do you know what I mean?
Well, yeah, a little bit. I mean, I think the guy who scored a really good goal had scored against West Ham last season, I think, and scored against Spurs. You know, they know about him. They're decent players. They're a decent team. Mm-hmm. You know, it's
That was one of the problems that Tuchel gave himself a job uninterviewed, didn't he? Because he just said, "Yes, I was surprised. I didn't expect this to happen. You know, a lot of this is my fault." And you think, well, that's kind of asking to be sacked. And also his demeanour. I think all season his demeanour has been, you know, you used to think he looked like a tactical genius because he's got that Tefal man kind of head going isn't he? Where you think he's moving back. And the next minute he looks like a teacher doing playground duty after cycling into work, you know, and demanding to know who pulled Cucciarella's hair.
and asking the VAR. But... apparently Burley was the one interested in taking Ronaldo off United because he wanted the big sort of marquee signing, and Tuchel said no to that, and apparently they were at odds after that. And perhaps Tuchel insisted that the owners look him in the eye when they shake hands, because that's a thing of his apparently that's emerged recently. You have to look him in the eye when you shake hands with him, otherwise he'll try and grab you by the neck like he did with Antonio Conte. So next, Graham Potter, apparently.
Well, and you think, you wonder, Graham Potter's going to walk into, you know, this new dressing room full of selfless team men like Fofana and Cucurella and of course the dirt in the fridge. And, you know, what's he going to make of that? And what are they going to make of him?
I hope that's going to stick as a nickname, the turd in the fridge.
I'm hoping the turd in the fridge will stick. I really am. I really am.
Oh, he might, you know, who knows? He might do well, but, you know.
He might stick for long enough that we can start calling him the turd at the bridge, which would be like a departure.
Or,
do you know what I mean?
Well, that's the second line of the poem anyway.
Yeah.
Pass that suggestion on to Ryan Giggs. See what he comes up with.
I mean, a Chelsea poem for you.
when they were first talking about, oh, Tuchel's gone, who next? Immediately, the three names they came up with: Potter, Pochettino, Zidane. Okay, now Zidane is obviously not going to go there, is he? He's not going to come to this country. He's far too French. But why? And the first thought was, why on earth would Potter want to leave Brighton now?
Well,
and you know, you have to choose between obviously an undoubtedly vast amount of money, but no job security, or a longer term plan that could only enhance his reputation.
There are little things.
They don't think like that.
Well, there are little things that make a difference. I remember when we signed Peter Beagrie from Sheffield United, and he came to us and he said, "Well, I'd been at Middlesbrough." you know, when they play in red and white, and I went to Sheffield United, they play in red and white, and Stoke play in red and white. So I thought, this could be a good move for me. And so I'm wondering if Graham Potter has noticed that in the King's Road, there's a pub called the Chelsea Potter.
Is
and
there?
Thought,
is
yeah,
there?
Oh, yeah. Well, hey. Of course, as Stoke fans, that's where
that's
you always
where
meet
you
when
go,
you play
course,
Chelsea.
Yeah.
Not for a long time, but yeah. That's exactly what you do. And they were also linked, by the way, with Brendan Rodgers. Brilliant.
What, just
recently?
This week? Yeah, really? Oh, wow. And there's a Portuguese man, the manager of Sporting Lisbon as
what,
well.
Called Brendan Rodgers?
No. It was also mentioned, I think. Yes. But they've been speaking to Potter, and you know, it's surely only a matter of time before Potter, you know, is given a big job. He's handed Pierre-Emerick Aubameyang to work with.
After the fridge.
No, that wasn't where I was aiming.
No, I know it wasn't.
I don't think I could aim into the fridge, even if I wanted to.
Okay, now I've gone off the whole line.
Yeah, exactly. But he's known, isn't he, Potter, for his meticulous preparation and for challenging his players with and by deliberately changing systems to suit opposition just to keep them on their toes so that they're thinking as well as acting instinctively. He's an interesting guy, I think. And it's interesting that Brighton have done so. And it's a shame, I think, that they didn't beat Fulham last midweek, because he could be leaving Brighton top of the table, which would have been... you know, would have been quite a thing, I think.
Yeah,
and it's amazing that they're, you know, he's got them into the top four, and immediately a job comes up and he's going immediately.
I like Graham Potter, one, because he used to play for Stoke, but two, because I think the reason he's gone to Chelsea because he doesn't want the England job. And by going to Chelsea, that'll probably be the end of that. Anyway, we should move on.
Well, shall we move on to the start of European football this week again? Mostly as business as usual, mostly the big giants flex their muscles and beat somebody 3-0 or 4-0, but there were some surprises. We've already just mentioned briefly Chelsea's defeat by Dinamo Zagreb with its cataclysmic aftermath. And then the shock result was Liverpool's collapse at Napoli. I mean, we should say, first of all, that the main reason for the 4-1 defeat, despite all the post-match analysis, was that Napoli played really well and made mugs of Liverpool's defence, particularly Joe Gomez in the first half, who kept getting robbed within range of the goal. But the sneaking suspicion, which has been building through the opening games of the season, reached its climax last night, is that teams have worked Liverpool out. And they play this such a high defensive line, and they try to compress everything into the opponent's half. But that depends not only on them timing their movements, the defenders, well enough to catch attackers offside. It depends on the midfield players in front of them protecting them in the middle, so that there's no time for a playmaker to look up and knock it over the top and catch them out. And what we're seeing more and more is Liverpool's middle being stretched wider and wider, too wide to do this. And so the killer ball is coming through or over the top over and over again. Last night, over and over again. It's like they'd worked out, this is what we're up against, this is how to play it, and they'd worked it out.
And also, if you know, Liverpool, if they are winning their ball, they're tending to win it wider, like you say, and to play a through ball for Liverpool to play a through ball is much more difficult. So it's going to have to down the channel, and that doesn't always work. And usually the wingers are coming back. So
well, because you hardly ever see Liverpool now attacking on the break, because they've always compressed things into the opposition half. They're always not quite be able to break down the edge of the area. And I think one thing you can't help thinking is that it was a system that relied more heavily on Sadio Mane to make it work than was realised, I think. I mean, not only as a goal scorer, but also he's incredibly fast, but also the player that defenders were most worried about of the famous three strikers, because Salah would stay out wide and Firmino would drop deep. Mane was the one they had to keep the closest eye on.
Yeah, because he would appear as if from nowhere.
Yeah. And it seems like teams are managing now. I mean, whenever you watch Liverpool, it seems like whoever they're playing against is able to smother Salah out on the right-hand side of the area, is able to double, triple-team Diaz, and no one is in. Well, Darwin Nunes hasn't done it yet. No one is occupying the defenders in the middle and making space for the others. Which, anyway, Klopp's got a bit of thinking to do, I think.
Yeah, I think he has. But in a much wider sense, of course, the other thing is that one of the reasons that Liverpool didn't concede as many goals that was that people were too fit to attack them because they thought they'd get round the back. And, it's a self-fulfilling prophecy that once you've shown a bit of weakness, teams start thinking, oh, what, it might be worth it. Well, let's have a little go.
Didn't it 2 years ago when they lost 7-2 to Villa? And it suddenly looked like, they'd been sorted out. And somehow he's tweaked it and fixed it then. And he has to kind of do that again.
I was just going to say, it's added into the rest of the hysteria, you know. Man City draw at Newcastle. The four goals of the apocalypse bring Liverpool down. But the truth of the matter is, they're saying all these things about Liverpool. And let's even play the game that they want to play, which is, say, that football began when the Premier League began.
Yes.
Okay, so that's 30 years. Well, talking about great seasons, probably four, maybe five really good seasons in 30 years.
Liverpool.
You know, it isn't completely inconceivable that they might stumble. The same as anybody else.
Yeah, true. Anyway, I went to a European game, not last week, the week before, when I was up in Edinburgh. I went to see Hearts play FC Zurich at Tynecastle, which has changed an awful lot since I was there. It's had a real facelift. It's a really great little ground. I say little, it's quite a big ground.
It's got toilets.
It's got toilets now, yeah.
Oh,
and electricity.
Yes, go for it.
No, I mean, it was packed and the atmosphere was terrific, although you wouldn't have wanted to be in the Zurich end. These massive flags swirling around for 90 minutes, big fireworks going off, smoke everywhere. You wouldn't have seen a thing. It's hard to think what they get out of it. But anyway, it was great to hear. I mean, you'll remember the old Hearts songs from when we used to go in previous Edinburghs with our old friend Rob, who we should get on to talk about the Hearts fan ownership thing. He's one. We haven't had a club owner on yet, have we? Rob is a part owner of Hearts. But, you know, the HEARTS, if you can spell it, then here's what it says. And, you know, frankly, if you can spell it, how did you find your way there? But anyway, Rob came up for the game, up to Edinburgh. It was great to see him. And managed to swing me a ticket off a bloke, even though it was only one ticket per owner. And he was convinced, this is such a football fan thing, he was convinced that Hearts were going to win 1-0, because now that they've got rid of the away goals rule, that would mean penalties, where previously it would have meant that they'd won. And that's the sort of fatalism a lifetime of following a club can give you, the idea that the world, fate has got it in for your team. Your team and your team. It was good. It was absolutely a great atmosphere. And there was a bloke behind me who just shouted, "Bastard!" at everything, at anyone who did anything, at anything. Just, "Bastard!" And it's great. Yeah. And that Scottish accent, you really get all the value from the consonants, I think.
Yeah. So often when we tell these stories about the bloke behind us, we're really telling the story about ourselves, aren't we, Chris? Was it you shouting "bastard" throughout the game?
I was the bloke behind Rob. Rob was the bloke.
Fair enough. Well, just briefly to finish the round up on the Champions League, because we have to go to a break in a moment. And talking of Scotland, my favourite thing this week on the BBC website, which is where I now get most of my football from, was after, I swear to you, 5 minutes, the update on the Celtic Real Madrid game was Celtic holding Madrid. 5 minutes in. And the other one that appalls me is just quiet shouts for Van Bronckhorst's head at Rangers. 24th of August, they beat PSV to qualify for the group stages of the Champions League. 7th of September was the first, people getting worried and wanting him out.
Well, they lost to Celtic,
and by the way, everybody with this massive panic, it's still only like just creeping into the second week of September.
Yeah.
It is early.
Wait
early
till the
day,
international break.
Well,
at the end of the month.
But, yeah. Although it's late days, I have to say, if you want a ticket to come and see the famous sloping pitch live.
Beautifully done.
Thank you so much. It's on in King's Cross at, where is it, Chris?
King's Place,
you see. And it's on Sunday and it's at 7 o'clock and you can contact King's Place. You can look on Twitter field. Yeah, Twitter field, Twitter feed. And if you don't come, we will leave a turd in your fridge.
And that's a promise.
Thinking about this panic early in September, you know, it's only 7 years, Liverpool fans remember, since you lost 6-1 at Stoke. When was the last time Liverpool lost at Oldham?
I think it was in 2013 in the Cup. They lost at Boundary Park 3-2. I went to watch that on the television with my sons. It was a great, great afternoon. Anyway, let us take a quick breather from the managerial rat race at the top end of the game and plunge instead into the laboratory where the rats have lost the will to race or find their way out of the little maze after being fed on a steady diet of disillusionment and despair by scientists who aren't getting any. I allude, of course, to the Vanarama National League, where my club, Oldham Athletic, sit now just below halfway, either poised for a surge into the playoff places or a plunge to the relegation slots or possibly a sidelong slide into stopping more or less where they are now for the foreseeable future. Last weekend, we welcomed league leaders Chesterfield to Boundary Park, and what a welcome we gave them. Our keeper began tooling around at the back right from the kickoff, got his pocket picked, and we were one down before we'd been in their half. 8 minutes in, more fannying around in the modern style by our right back, and we were two down, at which point everybody on both teams settled down and called it an afternoon. Playing against Chesterfield, one of Sheridan's former clubs, he only managed them twice, he's on his sixth stint in charge of us, gave the podcast Legends of the Spire the opportunity to run an interview with their former captain, Jonathan Smith, about Sheridan's management style during his time with them in the National League a couple of years ago. And it wasn't a great listen for Latics fans. Never really did tactics, apparently, talked about the opposition or worked out in advance who was going to play and who was going to play where. They used to call it team bingo, doing the bingo in the office to see who's going to play. Find out at 2 o'clock and start trying to get your head round it and hope for the best. Hope that the lads just pull it out of the bag. There wasn't tactics, there just wasn't. It was a real struggle, according to Jonathan Smith. In the interest of balance, let me also say that Andy Liddell, one of Sheridan's 2006-07 Oldham playoff squad, wrote in the programme recently, he was always a straight guy with us and told you what he wanted. If you didn't do it, you'd get nailed. However, Jonathan Smith's appraisal of late career Sheridan did strike an eerily chilling note, as it's been difficult to see quite what the plan is in the opening weeks of the season. Against Chesterfield, he stuck two low knees, 118 and 190, I think those were the shirt numbers, straight into the starting lineup, having only acquired them the previous day, lending credence to the notion that he just chucks the players out there and lets them sort it out for themselves. One of them was from Stoke, actually. Yes. David Okebu, they were calling him. It's hard to tell how to pronounce it because there's a G, it's a random G in it. But Okebu, they were calling him, who was our man of the match, actually. And the other was Charlie Wellens on loan from Man United, who's the son of our former player and manager, Richie Wellens, now the boss of Orient. Yes. And so it appears we're trying to take over from Stoke as the kids of former players team, because we've got Wellens, young Wellens. We've got young Nathan Sherrin, Mike's boy, and we've got Charlie Cooper, who is Mark Cooper's boy and Terry Cooper's grandson. So yeah, so we're we're kind of jostling for that crown. Anyway, Hallam Hope has started the season well. Last season, our relegation season, he was a bit of a whipping boy for the crowd, only scored 5 goals, looked lost as a lone striker. This time though, he's looked our main threat, has scored 3 goals and has become, in short, a new hope, making him our first Star Wars-themed player since we sold Eric Jedi and had that loan deal fall through for Jar Jar Binks. It was good in the air, apparently. The story emerged on Monday that he was in hospital, likely to be missing for several weeks because of serious injuries sustained when he was assaulted in the staff car park after the game on Saturday. Now, that's what I call a late tackle, is what our friend Paul messaged me. But at first, it seemed like unruly Oldham fans were to blame. And on the forum that I look at occasionally, there was no shortage of people pointing the finger at various gangs of kids who apparently go around looking for trouble. They sit just behind me in the such and such stand, and I bet it was them, kind of thing. And then there was a rumour that it was actually a carjacking, leading to some grudging backtracking on the local yobs are a disgrace to our club storyline, and inevitably demands for apologies to the now blameless yobos in question. But then there was a development, a story in the Mail, that the culprit was an unnamed Chesterfield player. I mean, just look at the back of his shirt. I don't know. Investigative journalism these days. But anyway, could still be a carjacking, of course, if one of the Chesterfield lads liked the look of Hallam's wheels. But whatever it was, I mean, what a terrible thing. There have been occasionally been stories, haven't there, about afters in the car park, you know, haven't there? But I can't honestly recall one where a player has ended up sidelined for several weeks with God knows what serious injuries.
I was following the stories it's progressing. Obviously, you know, that's inevitable. The sort of, oh, it's a gang of lads on they've round the corner for me. They're not nice. I think they nicked stuff out of our post box.
They should be banned. And then, they should be banned from sitting behind me and shouting, bastard.
But it's actually, the story grew, and it was a really nasty, nasty, nasty incident. And, you know, deeply unpleasant and not really suitable for
that. Well, the CCTV footage apparently, so presumably it should be an open and shut case when they're not revealing who they're talking about it being. But.
Well, you'll have to get a VAR first.
It's going to take at least 4.5 minutes for them to do anything.
I remember when the Ben Stokes fight outside the Bristol nightclub happened, and somebody posted the CCTV footage with snickometer on it to see if it actually hit him. Anyway, that's horrible too. But I did one of my favourite posts on one of the older message boards was from a bloke who said there really is no place for this. I mean, whatever happened between them, this sort of behaviour is disproportionate. Whoever did it should be burnt alive on the Boundary Park pitch. I wasn't sure two people had written it.
I mean, it's hard not to think of. I mean, I know obviously it's a terrible, terrible thing, and we wish him well. I mean, it's hard not to be reminded of other occasions though when footballers have been ruled out by non-footballing injuries. Rio Ferdinand reaching for his remote control, for instance, and Dave Besant dropping the salad cream and breaking his toe. It does happen. Obviously, everyday life can injure you, but this seemed, to be injured in an assault like this, I can't remember anything like it.
It's despicable and horrible. The only thing, the thing I noticed about Oldham was somebody else, while I was reading through the Hallam Hope thing, and I have to give the man a name because in case it's wrong, and then you can blame him. But if it's right, he can get the credit. His name's Ross Haynes, and he said that after Liz Truss became Prime Minister, that meant that Sheridan had managed Oldham under every Prime Minister since John Major at one stage or another. So that's Blair, Brown, Cameron, May, Johnson and Truss. He's managed Oldham.
Well, I mean, obviously it was as true the day before as it was on that day. And, you know, the only way of messing up that statistic would have been to have sacked him on Sunday, but still. But anyway,
transfers.
Yes, after we recorded last week's podcast, the transfer window finally closed. That ticking clock, counting down in fractions of a second, finally reached naught. Harry Redknapp finally went to bed, and it was time to start taking stock of what had happened. I mean, it's never as exciting as it's built up to be, is it?
Yeah.
Time, Man United buying Antony was literally the main headline on the back of the paper every day for a week. It took forever to be finally done and dusted. They ought to get a calendar that counts down in fractions of a year for the Sky Sports news program. They should get the graphic of a glacier or the construction of Stonehenge or something like that. They could run an episode of Emmerdale in the bottom corner. Nobody's watching. But anyway.
Well, I was going to say, as a televisual event, as an event in general, it reminds me of staying up to watch a boxing match at 4 o'clock in the morning, because actually you don't really know what's happened until about 9 o'clock the next morning, because you never actually get around to see it, do you? Or waiting for Christmas, waiting for Santa to come, you know. But really, just wait till the next morning. It's all going to be there then. It's not that exciting at the time.
Apparently, United just needed to dot the I's and cross the T's on Antony. That was the thing. But there aren't any I's in Antony. Were they spending all that time trying to work out whether he should have an H? Because he sometimes has an H and sometimes he doesn't. Anyway, that deal is not over and done with yet either, apparently, as there are three agents now, each claiming that they were the architect of the deal and each want 20 million for their trouble. They're finders, you know. So much more fun and games to come there, I think. But anyway,
I was hoping one would want frankincense, one would want gold, and one would want myrrh. That's what I was hoping. And it's sort of reverse.
Well, I don't think there's any sense in which either of these three men are wise. But anyway, once the dust settled, anyway, the stats for the summer transfer window as a whole, just astonishing. A Premier League club spent £1.92 billion, which is 67% up on last year when there was COVID still making clubs nervous, but 34% up on the previous record year of 2017. The most eye-catching stat, though, is that this amount, this total spend, represents 49% of spending across the top five European leagues added together. So Italy, 670 million. Bundesliga, 435 million. France, Ligue 1, 426 million. Spain's La Liga, 404 million. And that figure is bolstered by Barcelona having mortgaged their future to stay among the elite clubs while the European Super League law case drags out in Luxembourg. And this is what the other leagues have been afraid of, that the English Premier League will become so bloated with cash that it will blow away everyone else. And now this is what the impetus for the Super League was, where it came from. But arguably, the Super League is here already, and it is the English Premier League. The financial dominance the Super League craved has been claimed by our league. And it's all fuelled by a raft of new broadcasting deals that have lifted the Premier League up to another level. New deals with the NBC in America, with beIN Sports in the Middle East, and with India and Asia have boosted the package in this rights cycle to £10.4 billion. And the rest of Europe just can't live with that. I mean, naturally, the players gravitate towards the money. Which means that the Premier League clubs inexorably acquire the raw material to dominate for years to come. Whether they will or not depends on whether some of them can fix their dysfunctional management setups. And even top players lose form or get overplayed, like Liverpool and Chelsea, who played in all the possible matches they could play last year. But it was noticeable last night that when Osimhen of Napoli, even though he was carrying an injury, was terrorising the much-vaunted Liverpool defence, the commentators were saying, oh, he's destined for the Premiership, as though that was the next logical step up for a player doing well for a Serie A club, who are second, I think, currently. But anyway,
I find in terms of deadlines, the money keeps going up and up and up, and sometimes, you know, exponentially, like you say, you know, like three times as much as X or whatever. But I find that the actual transfer themselves become less and less and less significant, you know, in the sense that the shock value isn't there because everybody's available to anybody, and whether they'll actually keep them and hang on to them and they become central to that team, it's a very rare thing. I mean, Torres at Liverpool, that was a great signing, and you know, he was a really important player for them. Suarez as well. But a lot of players just seem to move around and around and around, and you think you know, De Bruyne and Lukaku, for instance, also, and you know, nearly everybody's played for Chelsea at some stage. Robin, you know, and that seems to be the way it is. So I like looking at it slightly more parochially. I very much enjoyed Newcastle's forays into the transfer market.
Well, you'd have thought, wouldn't you, that they were going to have a big window because of the Saudi thing. But actually, they've got one really big signing, haven't they? Alexander Isak, who looks fine. Eddie Howe was complaining that English clubs wouldn't sell anyone to them because they were worried about it. Yeah, but they're jealous. You know, they're worried they're going to do too well.
Well, yeah, but he actually said they've not been very fair to us. You just imagine, can you imagine somebody at a major company, you know, at the annual general meeting saying, well, we haven't done that well at Unilever, I'm afraid. But, you know, a lot of our competitors have been, well, frankly, competitive. But there were two great comments from Angus Kinnear. Well, predictable, but pleasing comments from Angus Kinnear at Leeds after they tried to buy Jack Harrison, and from Brendan Rodgers when they tried to buy James Maddison. So Angus Kinnear obviously said that £25 million for Jack Harrison would only buy his right leg, while Brendan Rodgers said that £45 million that the Newcastle offered for James Maddison would only cover three quarters of his left leg. Incidentally, both of those legs are their weaker legs, which I thought was good attention to detail. But I'm also thinking that possibly Mohammed bin Salman might think that this is a way to buy. They could actually build a plane. And the other thing about Mohammed bin Salman is he's got the staff that know how to cut up and dismember a human body.
He has the bone saws.
You know, so watch this space. That's all I'm saying.
Hey, watch your back, James Maddison and Jack Harrison.
VAR was the other big thing, wasn't it?
I mean, VAR had a terrible weekend, didn't it? I mean, I noticed that Tony Pulis, friend of the show, and more particularly of you, said on the BBC Radio 5 Live, it's not VAR. Let me get this correct. VAR just records the TV footage. It's the people who are running VAR. It's those human beings who are making the decisions. Now, I think what he's got hold of there, bless him, is a VCR. Okay? The VAR is the video assistant referee and is the human being making the decision.
You see, I wasn't sure about that. You see, I wasn't sure if that was true. I wasn't sure if there was a video assistant referee that then the extra referee, the fourth or fifth official, consults. But I did spot that myself.
It is a person, the video assistant referee, and I think there's a clue in the name to how it ought to work, which is not how it does work. That he's an assistant referee. That there's a status thing. I think part of the problem with the VAR, you know, as his name suggests, ought to be in a subservient position to the referee, assisting him. Whereas more and more, they seem to boss the referees about, bringing the referee over to the monitor to tell them that they're wrong. I mean, and this particular dynamic is only exacerbated when the VAR, the assistant referee, is a senior official. And the man on the pitch who's supposed to be making the decisions is junior to him, is a not-so-experienced official. And this is going to happen because the older referees, the more experienced referees, are drawn to the sitting down with the brew aspect of the VAR, you know. I think
it's the referee's equivalent of the booze panel.
Well, you know, and I think there were some good suggestions. Keith Hackett, the venerable referee commentator, had a 7-point plan. Not all, I wouldn't think all seven are worthy of discussion, but one or two. I mean, he suggested that part of the problem is with integrating the VAR, the referee, the person, not the VCR, with the refereeing team as a unit. Because one of the things that he championed was putting out the referee and the two linesmen as a team, as a unit, like they do now at the World Cup, don't they? When England are knocked out, there's an English referee and two English linesmen who go around together, kind of thing. And that the VAR should be more part of that team, which would mean closing Stockley Park and setting up the VAR at the ground where the thing is happening, which I'm not sure the scale of difference that would make, but I can't see that it would be a bad thing. And it would make the VAR part of the refereeing unit and part of the pre- and post-match discussions. And if they're used to working with one another, then you don't have this status anomaly, you know, where you've got a senior referee telling the junior referee he's made a mistake.
Absolutely. And the commentators say, you know, the moment the referee goes to the touchline, that they know what's going to happen, which is awful. I thought one of the Keith Hackett's 7 points that I particularly disagreed with was the annexation of the Sudetenland. I don't think that's going to help, to tell you the honest truth. It's been done before.
It's neither the time nor the place for that.
No, it isn't. But didn't one referee this weekend go and consult and not
true,
agree?
And that was Michael Oliver, who is, if anything, the most prominent of referees. And the part of the trouble with them.
So he's allowed to.
Well, he has the balls to do it, because the status is reversed in that situation. If he in his head is the top referee, who's going to tell him he's made a mistake? No one. You know, because this is what they're like. Yeah. These are the people that you're dealing with. You're not dealing with robots. Yeah. You're dealing with people, and you're dealing with a relationship between the VAR and the referee on the pitch that is unknowable in a way. It is only guessable at. You know, because Michael Oliver can go to the monitor. It was the handball for a penalty, wasn't it, in the Forest game, I think. And the VAR said, come and look at this. And he went, well, what's the problem with that? It's clearly a handball. It was almost like, who are you to tell me? And, you know, and if the referee has that attitude, then that's what will happen. And that's not necessarily right either. Yeah. But, you know, I think the problem with VAR, there are many problems with VAR, I think. But part of the problem with VAR is when it takes away from the referee on the pitch making the final call on things. And I think this is particularly, there have been a few of these lately, where a goal is questioned because of a foul a long way back in the build-up. And I can't stand that. There was one, Arsenal had one, didn't they, against Manchester United, who was, coincidentally, that game was being VAR'd by Lee Mason, the same guy who fucked up the day before. And it was such a good goal that, that's beside the point, but why VAR are looking at a foul that shouldn't be within their preserve, that shouldn't be within their brief. They should only be looking at, I think VAR should only be looking at the line, the offside thing. We're not getting that genie back in the bottle now. You know, that's a line
call. No, absolutely.
And, you know, it needs to be made. And now that we know it can be made, it will continue to be made. But when they're making a judgment on, you know, they're supposed to make judgment on red card fouls, aren't they? But when they're making judgments on fouls that are lesser fouls than red card fouls, that's the referee's job. And sometimes a player is going to get away with one of those. And if maybe the referee's seen it and he doesn't think it's quite enough for a foul, I don't think the VAR should be looking at those, at things which may be a foul or maybe not. That's what I think.
No. And also, how far do you go back? You know, you can go all the way back to they were in the tunnel and one player raised his hand to another player. So that player shouldn't have even been on the pitch. And so, that, you know, it's ridiculous. I loved your phrase about what the hell's it got to do with you? I'm the referee, which you said that he's able to say to the people in the VAR box. But that was what used to happen anyway. You know, you say to the players, I'm sorry. Are you refereeing the fucking game? Because I don't think so. I'm refereeing the game.
Yeah, but
that's
need to have
it.
That mentality to referee a game. And what is undermining the referees is this other referee whom they may regard as superior to them, or at very least senior to them, calling them and saying, look, you've made a mistake. I think you've made a mistake.
Yeah, absolutely. And I just wish they had a camera in Stockley Park. I'd love to see whether they sit there and they go, the moment there's a decision movement, they go, OK, this is our moment, this is it. This is where we stand up. We've got big things to do here. We're going to show them what we do. Or I like to think that they run around like Laurel and Hardy in circles, going, oh, no, we've got to make a decision.
Why don't you do something to help me?
That's what I'd like to think they're doing. And anyway, I'd like to just go back to, and I know this is a rubbish thing to say, but, you know, things even themselves out over the season is actually philosophically and statistically probably a better approach, to tell you the honest truth. The ball is round and people are fallible. That's part of the joy of the game.
I mean, it's also, you know, the thing is, it's people. It's people. Referees are people and VARs are people. They're the same sort of people. They're the same sort of bizarre weirdo that wants to referee in the first place. You know, and the referees get, like any other people, they get affected by what they see and what they hear out in the world. You know, our referees, it seems to me, especially this season, but also last a little bit, can't quite comprehend that Manchester City players can make a mistake. Look at the disallowed third goal that Palace scored last week when Edison let go of the ball and it got nicked off him and put in the net. What on earth was wrong with that? It was disallowed because it was City. It's the only reason. And referees can't believe that City players can make clumsy mistakes because they spend the whole week hearing that these are gods and this. Then Guardiola's a tactical genius. I mean, like the penalty that Stones should have conceded against Newcastle. Oh, no, it's City. They'll never do anything bad. They're footballing gods. I mean, and they've bought into the hype, even subconsciously, maybe, the referees. You know.
Yeah, and not. I think it's not even so much that. I mean, there is a lot of cheating in football. You know, that's true. Or an attempt to gain, marginal gains or whatever it is. And so they think, well, it's very unlikely that Newcastle would score this goal against Manchester City. And so, therefore, what am I missing? Yeah.
One of the most contentious VAR things at the weekend was when Bowen jumped over Mendy and he reacted as though his arm was off. You know, and that's just buying that decision, isn't it? That's just cheating. Buying that decision. Yeah. You could see quite clearly on the replay that his foot brushed him, and in a way that wouldn't affect a grown man. And then Mendy's practically on his way to hospital.
Well, and the other thing is, you know, and what's the future for referees? Because who's going to want to do it?
Exactly. Once you take their kind of supremacy over the situation away from them, you know, then every time you do that, it diminishes them, doesn't it? It diminishes the role and diminishes, as you say, people's desire to even do it. You know, it was interesting when looking at Edison throwing the ball out and it being nicked off him. This happened many years ago, didn't it? When George Best nicked the ball off Gordon Banks, I think it was England. Northern Ireland, wasn't it? And Banks threw it up and was going to kick it and Best nicked it and put it in. And it was like the referee couldn't work out what had happened, but because it was Gordon Banks, obviously he wouldn't have made a mistake because he was Gordon Banks. You know, and I think that's inevitably referees are going to have it was subliminally even a feeling that the best players are likely to be right in a given situation, you know.
Well, you know what? You've convinced me I am not going to become a referee. That is it. What I'm going to do instead is I'm going to open a shop only for championship referees who will seemingly buy fucking anything, as far as I can tell. Anyway, don't forget to come and see our live show if you can on Sunday. And if you don't, look in your fridge.
Sports Social Podcast Network.